Very great pleasure introducing an old friend, Marsden Wagner, who for the past 10 years has been responsible for maternal and child health in the European Regional Office of the World Health Organization. And Marsden is a single father of four children. So another one of his credentials, and here he is, Marsden Wagner.
Hello, everybody. I'm really delighted to be here, and I think one of the things I like about being at a meeting like this is that one does not find cues in the men's room. And with regard to being a man, I want to share with you one of the greatest compliments I ever received. Several years ago, I was chatting with one of this morning's speakers, Anne Oakley. And I said, "Anne, do you think I can ever be a feminist?" And she thought for a while, and then she said, "Well, I have bad news and I have good news. The bad news is no, you can never be a feminist. But the good news is that if it were ever possible for a man to be a feminist, you would be one." I want to start by bringing you the official greetings of the World Health Organization. And in fact, the first point I would like to make is that the World Health Organization endorses the idea that women should have the possibility of controlling their own birth and choosing the conditions of their own birth. And 7 years ago in the European region, we began to study birth. We formed a study group consisting of obstetricians and pediatricians and sociologists and psychologists and economists and midwives and nurses and so forth, and we looked at the situation in Europe with regard to birth, reviewed all the literature, and then finally we wrote an official WHO publication, which is called Having a Baby in Europe, and much of what I will be saying today comes from this book. This book has three main recommendations. One is that there is an urgent need to control the technology surrounding birth, much of which is inappropriate. The second major recommendation is to strengthen the central role of midwives in all birth. And the third recommendation is that birthing women should have the absolute right for informed choice concerning their birth. Now, when we say informed choice, we do not mean informed consent, because that's what doctors talk about. And of course, informed consent means that you consent to do what I decide and what I choose. And that's not informed choice. And the choice should, of course, include the choice about the place of birth. And the World Health Organization globally supports the idea of the community and individual control of all health care, including the health care around birth. And it supports the more traditional forms of health practices, such as home birth. I will read you one statement out of a 1985 WHO report out of Geneva, which is our global headquarters. Quote, "Where existing legislation presents a barrier to the promotion of traditional health practices, it should be repealed or amended and ultimately replaced by supportive legislation. The experience of countries shows that legislation prohibiting traditional practices does not succeed," end quotes. So WHO is behind you. The second point I would like to make is that home birth is really part of a much larger issue, an issue that I believe is an issue of power. Who will control the healthcare system in the various countries? Who will control reproduction? who will control women and their bodies? That's what it's all about. The healthcare system today is under the control of doctors and under the control of men. This male medical control leads to a male type of birth. The use of machines because we do not believe in women's bodies. The use of linear time, you know, putting birth by the clock and so forth. The rising cesarean section rates all around the world are really the tip of the iceberg of this male type of birth and this medical type of birth. In the United States today, over one-third of all babies are either cut out or pulled out of the woman. In Britain, it's over one-quarter of all babies are either cut out or pulled out of you. We men must take over and do the job because you women clearly do it very poorly. Now, don't be deceived. Doctors and men will not relinquish this power and control. They will appease, of course, and so there will be birthing rooms in the hospitals. But I feel that to have a birthing room in a hospital is like seeing the sign in the bakery window that says, "We sell home-baked bread." Now, in the struggle for the control of women, birth is a key issue. The integration of birth into the medical domain not only sets it adrift culturally, but initiates the breakdown of the entire cultural matrix. In other words, by convincing women that they are inadequate to give birth without assistance from the male system, you create a lifelong dependency on men and their medical expertise. Now, in birth, home birth is a key issue because in the home, the woman is in control. So again, we're talking control. This is precisely why doctors become so upset and so emotional whenever I say those two words, home birth. And reading out of this WHO publication, discussions of home birth usually generate much more heat than light, especially among health professionals. Clearly, some women need the specialized birth care of the hospital. Equally clearly, some women could just as well or better have their babies at home. What percent of women would choose planned home birth if given true informed choice is not known. There is a small but definite trend to planned home birth in some countries. So this is WHO talking. Now, in home birth, the woman gets continuous individual attention and caring, and most of all, gets that most important ingredient of all health care, as well as in birth. It's something called love. And I don't hear doctors talking about love. Now, the third point I want to make to you is that today there is a global crisis in maternity care and an international struggle between what we call the medical model of birth and the social model of birth. I'll give you a few examples of this global crisis and what's going on. In Greece, recent very careful studies show that 50% of all women giving birth in Greece are given a general anesthetic and put sound asleep during labor and birth. And in Greece, 70% of women have an artificially induced labor. There is clear evidence from our data in Greece that too many bigger babies die as a result. In Denmark, there has recently been a struggle over their new national perinatal guidelines. And now, home birth in that country is approved nationally. But at local level, you still find the struggle going on. In Hungary, we sent them a list of recommendations that came out of one of our meetings on appropriate technology for birth, and one of those recommendations said that women should have informed choice. The obstetrical organization in Hungary wrote a letter back to us and said that in Hungary, only we doctors are capable of deciding about birth. In Canada, I have personally testified in court twice when midwives who were attending home birth have been arrested. In Canada, doctors who back up home birth are given all kinds of sanctions and punishments. I don't know where to begin when it comes to the United States. As you may know, many midwives attending home birth have been arrested and thrown in jail. In the United States, 70% of all obstetricians have been sued. And they, as was said this morning, they want to blame the lawyers and blame the women. While I am inclined to feel that if you play God, don't be surprised if you get blamed for the natural disasters. The only word that I can think of that I feel describes the American maternity situation is obscene. In the United Kingdom, you all probably know about what happened to Wendy Savage. It's less well known, but many midwives in the United Kingdom are being, in one way or another, punished or suspended. You know, this global crisis also includes the more developing countries. In Brazil, some of the large hospitals have 70, 80, or 90% cesarean section, while in that same country, there are vast numbers of women with little or no care during pregnancy and birth. And in the developing countries, there's a real elitism that predominates in the health care. Now, the next point I want to talk about is, well, what can we do about all of this? I must tell you that the obstetrical community is well organized nationally and internationally. Everywhere I go to many different countries, I hear the same statements from them. For example, about the cause and effect relationship between rising hospital birth and falling perinatal mortality. And then, of course, they start talking about safety, because safety is the bludgeon that they use to control the women. And I really don't want to talk about safety, because the next speakers this afternoon will talk about it much more. But just for the record, let me read you out of a WHO publication. It is important to remember that it has never been scientifically proven that the hospital is a safer place than the home for a woman who has had an uncomplicated pregnancy to have her baby. Studies of planned home birth in developed countries with women who have had uncomplicated pregnancies have shown morbidity and mortality rates for mother and baby equal to or better than hospital birth statistics. These studies have also found significantly fewer interventions used in home births. Now, the international obstetrical community is well organized. They have an organization that's called FIGO. That means the Federation International for Gynecologists and Obstetrics. They have really been working hard to get the World Health Organization to be on their side. I just want to give you one quick example. They organized an international meeting to draft guidelines for the use of electronic fetal monitors during labor. And they wanted WHO to be part of this, and they invited us. The first thing we found when we got to the meeting was that all of the obstetricians from all over the world who had come to this meeting to draft objective guidelines about the use of the electronic fetal monitor had had their plane tickets paid by the companies who make the monitors. And in order to get into the room where the guidelines would be drafted, we had to walk through another room filled with these same companies exhibiting their monitors. Now, in spite of the fact that the World Health Organization representatives stated that there was no scientific justification for routine monitoring of every laboring woman, when the draft guidelines came out, they recommended routine monitoring of every laboring woman. I won't go into all the details of what happened then, except to tell you that WHO said, either you change that or we are not going to be part of this party. And after some very difficult negotiations, and I must say some of which I would describe as devious, they finally had recommendations that do not recommend routine monitoring of every woman. But I want to make the point that the methods that they use are aggressive, are intimidating, and are threatening. Now, on the other side of this struggle, we have a very strange mix. We have women's groups, we have feminists, we have parents' groups, we have religious groups, we have epidemiologists and other medical scientists, and we have the more courageous public health authorities. Usually these groups are all very poorly organized, and but when they do get organized and when they involve the media, they usually win. They won in Denmark. Denmark now has good national guidelines. They got organized and they involved the media. They are winning in the province of Ontario in Canada, where a midwife was, you know, midwifery is illegal in Canada, and a midwife was taken to court. The result of the court battle is that they are now drafting new legislation in Ontario to legalize midwifery. And as we Wendy Savage won. So and in this struggle, I feel that the most important tool that is on the other side is again this strange phenomenon called love. I am a medical doctor and I am a man and I'm on this other side in this struggle. And the most difficult thing for me personally has been to learn how to be loving in my work. Normally, I don't talk to people like are here today. Normally, I'm facing a room full of angry obstetricians. And if I can find the strength to be humble, to be loving, and non-judgmental, it's really amazing what can happen. Now, in this struggle, I feel that the most important issue is that of informed choice. That includes information and it includes choice. Full information is a very, very important and precious thing, and in general, you do not have it. The doctors are telling you that ultrasound scanning of every pregnant woman is essential and safe. The science shows that we don't know whether it's of any value at all done on every pregnant woman, and we do not know if it's safe. But we're making progress. I think the Good Birth Guide in Britain, which for those of you who don't know, is a kind of Michelin guide of restaurants for all birthing places in Britain, which tells the woman what she can expect if she goes to this place or that place. This has had a very important part to play in the United Kingdom. In Massachusetts, in the United States, they have a new law that says that anybody can go to a hospital and demand and get all of their hospital statistics on cesarean section, on episiotomy, on anesthesia, on everything. So you now have freedom of information about birth in that one state. But it's going to be a long struggle to get this information. Another positive example of the information is that we organized this meeting in Fortaleza, Brazil, and we published some recommendations with regard to the technology of birth in Lancet. These recommendations, which include fully informed choice, were picked up by women's groups in Italy who made them into a big poster and started posting them all over health centers in Italy. This was picked up in Britain and produced in large numbers as posters in Britain. It was picked up in France, translated into French, and now there are French posters. It has been translated into Portuguese and will be distributed in Brazil, etc., etc. And the point here is that if a woman wants informed choice and wants some of these other things, and the medical establishment says, no, that's foolish, she can then point and says, well, look what the World Health Organization says. So it's a kind of support. But it's informing the women that this is a perfectly reasonable and scientifically legitimate information. Now, when it comes to choice, choice is control. So we're back once more to power and control. And doctors will take away your choice, and they take it away by intimidating you and scaring you and threatening you. But choice, we feel, is absolutely fundamental to good birth. And I will finish by reading you the last few sentences out of this WHO publication. It is essential for the woman to feel she is in control if she is to be able spontaneously and effectively to open herself to give birth. Consequently, the feeling of having choice, and therefore of being in control, is perhaps more important than what she chooses. Everyone, health providers, users, society, agrees that the death of a woman or a baby is a tragedy to be prevented if at all possible. At the same time, human beings have always felt that certain other things are as important as survival, including the freedom to live their own lives their own way and to make individual choices in line with their own sense of values as well as the values of their own society. Thank you.
Thank you, Marsden. On the subject of statistics, our next speaker stumbled across some very interesting ones earlier on in her career. And may I welcome Marjorie Tew. Thank you.
The organizers of this splendid gathering have asked me to describe to you how it came about that such an unlikely person, who is unconnected with the maternity service, who's neither a midwife nor a doctor, and whose own experience of childbirth finished long ago, should have been the one to explode the myth that home birth is less safe, to expose the fact that modern maternity care in Western medicine is based on a theory which has never had any justification in practice. The theory is that the process of birth is made safer for mother and child by obstetric management and the use of invasive interventions, which advances in scientific research have made increasingly sophisticated. These practices are assumed to make birth safer, not only when a complication has arisen or is predicted because certain biological and social risk factors are present, but also where a complication has not yet arisen, but might arise even in the absence of predicting risk factors. Thus, the most safe place for all births, whether at high or low predicted risk, is claimed to be the specialist hospital, where obstetricians are in control and equipment for intervention is at hand, while the mother's home, where these provisions are lacking, is condemned as the least safe place, even for births with little risk of complication. If these basic assumptions were valid, then we should certainly expect two results. One, that mortality rates for comparable groups of mothers or babies at the same predicted risk would always be lowest in obstetric hospitals. And two, that increasing the proportion of births in these hospitals would cause a related reduction in overall mortality. This is what we have all been taught to believe, and this is certainly what I expected to find when I first confronted the problem in 1975. I was then teaching students in the Department of Community Health at Nottingham Medical School how to make use of publicly available medical statistics, and I set them and myself the exercise of seeing how much we could learn from these sources about maternal mortality and the perinatal mortality of babies. To my great surprise, the English data then available supported neither of the basic assumptions. Simple calculation revealed that maternal and fetal death rates for comparable groups were always higher in hospital than at home, whether the predicted risk on account of the mother's age or size of family was high or low, and also that the years when births in public hospitals had increased most were not the years when national mortality rates had decreased most. These facts are crucial to the determination of policy, if the objective of maternity care is to make birth safer. Surely, I thought, the medical profession could not know about them and would want to be informed at once so that policy could be modified accordingly. My next great surprise was how much hostility and opposition greeted my attempts to have the facts reported in influential medical journals. The revolutionary findings of an unknown laywoman were dismissed either as nonsense or as of no interest to their readers. When my first article was published in 1977 in a non-medical journal, it provoked not just medical interest, but medical outrage. Nevertheless, though no sound evidence could be produced to refute my inferences, medical composure was soon restored by adopting defenses of professional deafness and personal ridicule. If my early findings were correct, they were tremendously important. But if they were to convince the opposition, they had to be confirmed by deeper analysis of additional data. And so, working on my own, since my contract in the Department of Community Health was not renewed in 1976, and I was prevented from discussing issues with university colleagues, I pressed on with my researches in my spare time. Each new set of data I found and each method of analysis I tried pointed to the same conclusions as before. Only occasionally was I able to break the opposition of the most influential medical press, but I found other outlets and so made my message known to some people and organizations, many of them represented at this conference. They were to give me much valued encouragement when I was most frustrated and depressed at my failure to have my findings considered seriously by those responsible for organising the maternity service and for teaching medical and midwifery students. The data I found seldom answered my questions directly, and I had to exercise considerable ingenuity to piece together information from different sources to build up a coherent picture, to refine my analyses, to strengthen my conclusions, to unmask the myths that had been created and accepted through muddled thinking and a wanton disregard of the rules of simple arithmetic. When later data singled out the specialist obstetric from the non-specialist general practitioner hospitals, it became clear that it was the years with the greatest increase of births in obstetric hospitals which were the years with the smallest decrease in mortality and vice versa. Statistically, this negative correlation was high and very likely to be real, that this was because they had all the cases at high predicted risk. And everyone believed that this claim was true and that it offered an arithmetically sufficient explanation. But even the obstetricians' own surveys demonstrated that this claim was a gross exaggeration, and elementary analysis showed that it was an arithmetically very insufficient explanation. More importantly, the surveys confirmed that mortality was highest in obstetric hospitals for subgroups at all levels of predicted risk, high and moderate as well as low, at least in respect of single risk factors like the mother's age or her social class or the baby's birth weight. Obstetricians then had to claim that hospital births were at higher risk on account of the combined risk of multiple factors. The analysts of the 1970 perinatal survey, perhaps unwittingly, provided an analytical instrument by means of which this claim could be evaluated. They constructed a composite labor prediction score, which incorporated the most important, the most frequently encountered risk factors, from those known at the start of pregnancy to those developing during pregnancy or labor. A score was assessed retrospectively and without bias for every birth in the survey. The births with the associated deaths could then be classified by score and place of birth, so that mortality rates at each level of risk at each place could be compared. Births in obstetric hospitals, whether there through selective booking or later transfer, could be compared with births at home or in non-specialist hospitals at the same level of risk at the same stage of delivery. This analysis, however, was not included in the published report of the survey. It wasn't until 1981 that I dared to ask for the unpublished data, and after 2.5 years of my persistent campaigning, the information was finally released to me. It took me nearly another 2 years to persuade a medical journal to print it, the reasons given for rejection being as spurious as ever. Slide, please. The results, as you can see, turned out to be devastating to obstetricians' claims. For at every score, at every level of risk, specific mortality rates were highest by far in obstetric hospitals. Births with low scores, and so without complications, were twice as safe at home or in non-specialist hospitals. But more surprisingly, births with higher scores, reflecting complications such as hypertension, hemorrhage, premature delivery, fetal distress, were even more likely to have a safe outcome outside the obstetric hospital. There may well be certain pathological conditions where obstetric care is safer, but clearly there were too few for this to be reflected in any prediction score. Always they were far outnumbered by cases where obstetric care was obstetric management made birth less safe. It follows that if the mortality rates for the vast majority of births at all levels of predicted risk were higher in obstetric hospitals, then increasing the numbers which took place there could not possibly reduce the mortality rate for all births. The obstetricians' claim that it did is seen to be absurd. The inference from the strong statistical correlation that increasing hospitalization caused the overall mortality rate to fall by less than it would otherwise have done is strongly supported. More recent studies from other countries have confirmed that in all comparable groups, except perhaps the tiniest babies, mortality and morbidity are always lowest for births least subject to obstetric interventions. Recent trials by obstetricians themselves have failed to demonstrate that certain common interventions like electronic fetal monitoring or ultrasound scanning or those to prevent post-maturity have made most births safer. Such trials are inevitably based on restricted numbers of subjects. The statistics referring to wider national populations were consistently telling me that obstetric interventions as a whole, contrary to their intended purpose, must actually be making most births less safe. But was this interpretation compatible with scientific reality? Yes, indeed, it was and is, for reasons which I had to learn from experts in the physiology of childbirth. They have explained the mechanism through which any disturbance to the wonderfully complex and coordinated process leads to further disturbances to the integrated sequence, so that the process is made less efficient and so less safe. Thus, the findings of statistics prove to be consistent with the expectations of biology. Obstetricians and those responsible for the maternity services have now had 10 years to produce evidence which refutes the conclusions implied by my statistical analysis of their results. They have not been able to demonstrate that hospitals, with their increasing facilities for high technology interventions, have made birth as safe as birth at home without any such facilities. There must then be some other explanation for the great decline in mortality in the last 40 years. As in all living species, healthy offspring are most likely to come from healthy parents. There is abundant evidence that childbearing women have become steadily healthier throughout this century, better fed, better sheltered, fitter to reproduce, so healthy indeed that they and their babies have successfully withstood the dangers of obstetric management. The importance of my work lies not in how I came to do it, but in what I found, in the misconceptions I exposed. Even if no single statistical finding can be accepted as by itself conclusive, the complete concordance of so many statistical findings and their consistency with the biological cause and effect relationships must be accepted as confirming the true explanation of what makes childbirth safe. Make no mistake, the real issue is no longer one of safety, but of professional self-interest. Our task is now to persuade medical and political authorities to cease their false propaganda and reorganize maternity services and the education of birth attendants in accordance with biological and statistical reality. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marjorie. Julie Jews, if you're here, your little one would very much like to see you in the creche, please. Our next speaker, Ronna Campbell, is currently a lecturer in social research methods and statistics at the University of Ulster. While a doctoral student at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, she undertook a major national survey on home birth. Ladies and gentlemen, Ronna Campbell.
Thank you. Okay, that's the title of my talk, just in case you haven't got a program. In a book called Notes on Lying in Institutions, published in 1871, Florence Nightingale wrote, "It must be admitted at the very outset of this inquiry that midwifery statistics are in an unsatisfactory condition. But with all their defects, midwifery statistics point to one truth, namely that there is a large amount of preventable mortality in midwifery practice, and that as a general rule, the mortality is far, far greater in lying in hospitals than among women lying in at home." This quote is interesting because it shows that debate on safety and the place of birth isn't new. It also highlights a problem which still hampers discussions today, and that is the lack of reliable statistical and epidemiological information. In addition, it illustrates that hospitals have been, in the past at least, associated with an increased risk of death. What I aim to do in this presentation is to summarise the evidence relating to the relative merits of the various places of birth and to detail some conclusions which would seem to be justified in the light of this evidence. In doing so, I shall refer almost exclusively to data from England and Wales. Although this may seem unforgivably ethnocentric, particularly given this wonderful international audience, the reason I do so is that one cannot just talk about the place of birth without having regard to the system of maternity care and the type of people who provide it. As these vary enormously from country to country, any review of the international evidence would take several hours rather than 15 minutes. To begin with, it's important to set the scene by looking at trends in place of delivery. The major trend has, of course, been towards institutional delivery. In 1927, when the Registrar General first tabulated births by place of delivery, only one in seven births occurred in institutions. By 1970, the position was reversed, with seven out of every eight births occurring in hospital. Most recent figures show that in 1985, only 0.9% of births occurred at home. Another relevant trend is, of course, the decline in the perinatal mortality rate. As this slide shows, it has declined at a markedly steady pace. Statistically, then, it is easy to demonstrate what is called a negative correlation between the institutional delivery rate and the perinatal mortality rate. In other words, there appears to be a relationship between the falling perinatal mortality rate and the rise in the number of births taking place in hospital. Much of recent policy on place of birth in the United Kingdom appears to have been based on the conviction that these trends are causally related. For example, in the introduction to the second report of the Maternity Advisory Services Committee, published in 1984, the chair, Alison Munro, echoed the views expressed by previous committees when she wrote, "The practice of delivering nearly all babies in hospital has contributed to the dramatic reduction in stillbirths and neonatal deaths, and to the avoidance of many child handicaps." A strong statistical association, however, isn't necessarily indicative of a causal relationship. Indeed, a number of detailed analyses of this association published in the medical literature do not support her claim. Thus, the first conclusion that one can draw is that the statistical association between the increase in the proportion of hospital deliveries and the decline in the crude perinatal mortality rate seems likely to be coincidental rather than causal. George Bernard Shaw, the famous Irish playwright, who, although confessing to be out of his depth as far as the technique of correlation was concerned, was only too aware of the way in which it could be abused, when he wrote in the preface to his play The Doctor's Dilemma, "To advertise any remedy or operation, you only have to pick out all the most reassuring advances made by civilization and boldly present the two in relation of cause and effect. The public will swallow the fallacy without a wry face. It has no need for what is called a control experiment." What did Shaw mean when he wrote of the need for a control experiment? In terms of the place of birth, a control experiment would involve randomly allocating pregnant women into two groups, a control group who would deliver in hospital and an experimental group who would deliver at home. Outcomes for the two groups would then be observed. Because women would be randomly allocated into the two groups, any differences in outcome greater than those expected by chance could be attributed to differences in the place of birth. For statistical reasons, the numbers required to take part in a trial assessing differences in perinatal mortality would be prohibitive. Nevertheless, this approach has great potential when it comes to looking at other outcomes, such as morbidity, that is illnesses, and parental satisfaction in relation to the place of delivery. In the absence of any experimental evidence, research workers have only been able to analyse the limited observational data available. What do the results of these observational studies show? Until 1975 in England and Wales, perinatal mortality rates subdivided by place of birth were only available from cross-sectional studies. Many of these were small-scale local surveys, but as Marjorie has already told you, two major national surveys were carried out in 1958 and 1970. Despite variations in scale and location, these studies all revealed a substantially lower perinatal mortality rate for births occurring at home when compared with the overall rate for births in hospital with specialist obstetric facilities. The problem here is that it's difficult to know whether the lower perinatal mortality rate for births occurring at home arose because of differences between those women who are delivered at home and in hospital which result from selection, or whether they can be attributed to the different places of birth. This slide shows diagrammatically the possible changes that can result from the selective forces, both social and medical, which determine where a woman gives birth. It also illustrates the complexities inherent in analysing any data about the place of birth. Statistical manipulations can be used to try and make allowances for the effect of selection, but there must always remain some doubt about the effectiveness of these. The conventional explanation for higher perinatal mortality rates in consultant units has always been that high-risk women are selectively referred to deliver there, and hence an increased baby death rate is only to be expected. As Marjorie Chew has already indicated, she challenged this conventional wisdom by undertaking an alternative analysis of the 1970 British Birth Survey. This slide contains the results which Marjorie has already shown you. And as she told you, these indicated that perinatal mortality was significantly lower for the births which took place at home and in general practitioner units when compared with those occurring in hospital. Although these results lend no support to the view that hospital is the safest place for all women to give birth, caution in the interpretation of these findings is required for a number of reasons. Firstly, the labour prediction score has not been widely validated using data from other data sets, and thus its true predictive ability is not known. Secondly, deaths resulting from causes unlikely to be related to the place of birth, such as lethal congenital malformations, were not excluded from the analysis. Finally, we cannot be sure that all the selection biases have been allowed for. Attempts to explain mortality differentials in terms of known risk factors in other areas of medical research have often failed to account for even half of the observed differences. Nevertheless, on the basis of Marjorie Chew's work and that of others, including myself, I think it's reasonable to conclude that there is no evidence to support the claim that the safest policy is for all women to deliver in hospital. I can tell you that's the first time anyone's ever clapped when I've shown that. It gives you some idea of what my normal audience is. Since 1975, the Office of Population Census and Surveys have linked birth and death registration data in such a way as it's now possible to produce perinatal mortality rates by place of birth. As you can see from this graph, by 1977, the perinatal mortality rate for home births had risen to a level above that for births in consultant units. And indeed, you can see that these trends persist in data for more recent years. For some, these data appeared to confirm what they'd always believed, but up until then had some difficulty in proving, and that was that home births were inherently dangerous. The statisticians who produced the data urged that it should not be taken at face value. Unfortunately, their comments went unheeded, and the original graph was reproduced in a report by the House of Commons Social Services Committee with the following comments. Most serious is the fact that by 1977, perinatal mortality in home deliveries was actually higher than in consultant units. Although these include a proportion of mothers at high risk who have deliberately eschewed hospital care, these data must increase concern about the safety for any mother of a home delivery. And the committee went on to recommend that home delivery is phased out further. It was suggested that the reason for the increase in the perinatal mortality rate for home births might be because the rates were calculated on the basis of the actual place of birth. However, not everyone giving birth at home intends to give birth there. Some will be booked for delivery in hospital, but because of a rapid or unrecognized labor, may give birth at home accidentally. Others may do so because they're attempting to conceal their pregnancies. The mortality for babies born to these women is likely to be high. As the absolute number of home births declined, so it was suggested, the proportion of unplanned deliveries was likely to increase and have a greater influence on the overall perinatal mortality rate for births at home, inevitably causing it to rise. In 1981, I started the home birth survey in order to find out the intended place of delivery for all births occurring at home in 1979. As you can see from the percentages in the second column there, the results show that only 2/3 of births had been booked as such. Of the remainder, 15% had been booked for delivery in consultant units, 6% for delivery in a GP bed, 3% were unbooked, and for 9% we were unable to identify the intended place of delivery. More recent survey work has shown this still to be the case. The perinatal mortality rate for planned home births was very low at 4.1 per thousand. For births planned to occur in consultant units, it was significantly higher at 67.5 per thousand. In addition, I found mortality was low for babies weighing over 2,500 grams, irrespective of where the delivery had been planned to occur. It was also very low for those babies born to women who had already had one child. It's not possible to conclude from these results, as the Daily Express newspaper did, that home births are completely safe, because we were unable in our calculations to include those women who planned to give birth at home but were transferred into hospital at the last minute. Other studies have shown the mortality for this group to be high. What we can say, however, is that the rise in the crude perinatal mortality rate for births at home can almost certainly be explained by an increase in the proportion of unplanned births at home relative to those planned to occur there, a consequence of the fall in the overall number of home births. And that the home birth survey also showed that the risk of perinatal death for women having a planned home birth appears to be low, particularly for women who have already had one child. Mortality is not the only way of measuring safety, and indeed, as it continues to fall, other measures such as morbidity and parental satisfaction are now becoming increasingly important. There have been quite a few studies of morbidity in similar samples of women giving birth at different locations. Two recent studies reported that babies born in consultant units had lower APGAR scores, meaning that the babies were in poorer condition at birth. Other studies have also shown higher rates of episiotomy and tears in women booked for hospital delivery. This leads me to the conclusion that there is some evidence, although not conclusive, that morbidity is higher amongst mothers and babies cared for in an institutional setting. For some women, the iatrogenic risk associated with institutional delivery may be greater than any benefit conferred, but this has yet to be proven. Given the rapid and sustained decline in deliveries outside consultant obstetric units, one might be forgiven for thinking that women preferred hospital delivery. All the research that has been done, however, shows the reverse to be true. Those studies which have focused on women who have experienced home and hospital delivery found that the vast majority preferred home. The most common reasons given for this preference was that home delivery did not involve separation from family and friends. Other reasons given, including negative feelings about the quality of obstetric care in hospital, were mentioned, but less often. Although a majority of women who have experienced both home and hospital delivery in the United Kingdom have expressed a preference for home delivery, estimates suggest that 10 to 20% of women would opt for a home birth given a free choice. It's a great privilege to be able to speak at the first international conference on home birth, and for me, a very unusual one, in that I suspect most of the audience are already convinced that home births are a good idea. Most of the health professionals I normally speak to think it's a very bad idea because home birth is unsafe and the only safe place for a baby to be born is in hospital. As Marjorie Chew and I have tried to illustrate, there isn't any scientific evidence to support that point of view. As we live in a scientific age, and as the people who provide healthcare in the so-called developed world purport to do so on a rational and scientific basis, those of us who want to see changes in maternity care are going only to be successful if the arguments are also put forward in scientific terms. In the time available, it has only been possible to give a thumbnail sketch of the debate and the evidence surrounding the question of where a baby is to be born. I'm afraid this may seem like terrible self-publicity, but if any of you would like to read a more comprehensive review, then copies of this booklet are available from the concourse upstairs, priced £2. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rona.